Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And there's days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
Can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
And I am Dave, your host. And today on the podcast, this is a talk by Acharya Eric Spiegel from about a month ago, and it's about becoming a Buddhist formally. What does it mean? What does it entail to officially declare oneself a Buddhist? Is there paperwork involved? Do I need a lawyer? No, what does it mean to say that one is a Buddhist officially? And what is the refuge vow, which is the vow that one takes to declare oneself as a Buddhist? So this is a very interesting talk, and there's some great questions towards the end, so definitely listen to the whole thing. Visit us at ny.shambhala.org for all of our upcoming classes and retreats. In particular, our next Shambhala Training Weekend 1 is happening the weekend of May 5th. That's with Lodro Rinzler, regular contributor to the podcast. And as you may or may not know, Shambhala Training Weekend 1 is the introductory weekend to our series of weekend meditation intensives. So check that out on the homepage at ny.shambhala.org or click classes and programs for other great courses coming up later this spring. And now, here is Acharya Eric Spiegel.
The talk tonight is about the refuge vow, which is the the entry, the formal gateway of becoming a Buddhist. So Shambhala is a meditation center, and we teach a branch of Buddhism or a style of Buddhism which is called Shambhala, but we're part of an ancient tradition going back to the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, who lived about 2,600 years ago in India. And and the way the Buddhist teachings have evolved or carried forward is that the Buddha had a particular experience of his own wisdom and his own humanness, and it was called awake. So it's kind of interesting. This is a year where the word awake or woke is suddenly in the language again, but it's actually been in our language for a long time, and it means pretty much the same thing, I think, that you actually see clearly and know what is. And a lot of times we don't those things. See clearly and know it is. We step out of our house in the morning and we have no idea. We can feel that there are energies, but we have no idea what they are or how to interact with them properly and how to actually bring our aspirations forward. So the idea of awake is that you actually see more than just what is in front of you, but you see the depth and the nature of yourself, and also of the world, of others, of beings, and of phenomena, of sky and earth, and seasons. So the process of a lot of people connect with the Buddhist teachings in different ways and feel an affinity for the Buddhist teachings and may think that they are essentially Buddhist. And so just like if you were being confirmed or bat mitzvahed, that there's an entry. And the entry has to do, we say vow, so the process is taking a vow called refuge. And vow is really meaning an important concept, I think, because most of the time We just go along with our life from the day we're born. And things happen and sort of different streams kind of intersect with us and shift us a little bit here and a little bit there, and we meet people and they say, oh, why don't you come along with me? And we check it out, and maybe we go a ways with them, maybe we go a long way with them, or maybe we skid off at some point. But in any case, there's a lot of sense that we don't actually really have a sense of where we're going. And maybe when you were five you did, and you were going to be a nurse or a doctor or a fireman, but a lot of times, once by the time we are past puberty, we've lost our sense of clarity about our vision about ourselves. So, so vow is about saying something clearly. And from the point of view of that, it's important to know if you're going to take a vow that it's the right vow, right? So you, how many people have taken the wrong vow with someone? It's not uncommon. So, oh yeah, I think I'm going to hitch my wagon to this one and bumpy ride. So... So vow isn't the first thing you do when you start practicing meditation, but it might be something that you develop conviction that you want to do, that it's important to do. And so so every year we offer this program, which is called Becoming a Shambhala Person, in which we offer the refuge vow and a secondary vow called the Bodhisattva vow. And this evening, I'm kind of just giving you a little window. So, for one thing, just people can know about it and have an idea of the path. Because today, meditation and mindfulness is very common, and we have been in Shambhala teaching mindfulness meditation for 47 years, and since the founding of Shambhala in 1970. And from a larger perspective, in the Buddhist tradition, we've been teaching mindfulness for 25 or 2600 years. But now many people are teaching mindfulness in the workplace and in the senior centers and in community centers of all kinds, and but there's kind of there's sort of like a two-step situation, and one is the meditation practice, which is about coming into oneself and coming in when we're learning. It's about learning how to distinguish between your thoughts and your actual experience, and the continual movement of emotions and discursiveness, and actually learn how to actually be present despite or in inclusive of all of your thoughts and emotions. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is, well, is that where you, that's fine. And then for those who are looking or are intrigued or connect, there's also a journey to be had. And the journey is, the meditation isn't by itself intrinsically spiritual. The meditation is just about connecting with reality in a very simple way, which anyone could do. But then there's also this thing called the spiritual journey that's really an exploration of oneself and of developing heart and strengthening heart and transforming the balance between the way our society, most of us, not everyone, but the dominant factor of modern society everywhere now is conceptual, Like, how good are you at things? How successful are you? How much can you put it together and hold it together? As opposed to the more traditional values of feeling and holding and touching and communicating and sharing. And it's not that one is better or worse. It's that they're both completely necessary. You have to be able to keep it together. And you also, it would be really, really good if you could also feel and have empathy and support people who are in need in the moment, in a larger sense, societally, which obviously is a pretty hot topic, but also just in the moment, we are so uncomfortable with other people's suffering and not knowing how to engage directly with them if they're in need medically or psychologically or financially or just because they've gotten older or because they're very young and they need protection and support and guidance. So this is what I would call the spiritual journey, is how do we actually become someone who can actually see the world clearly enough to be of benefit. So it's not just about good ideas, because there have been lots of bad good ideas. and they're, frankly speaking, a dime a dozen. But but how do we actually see the, in the Buddhist teachings we say the interdependence, how things actually play against each other and interfold and depend on each other. And so that's really what we would call, begin to call wisdom. So when we take refuge, this is what we're saying, is we're saying that I make a commitment. So refuge is has a thousand layers to it, and in a short talk I can't talk about all of them, but I'd like to talk about a few of them. What it means, essentially what it's saying is, what does it mean to become a Buddhist, to say, I am a Buddhist? For one thing, does it mean that you're not anything else? Like if you are whatever tradition and family and cultural and religious heritage you come from, you know. So it probably doesn't mean you're not those things, but maybe it means you're them in a different way. So I'm very much an Eastern European Jew from the Lower East Side. I will be that till the day I die. But at the same time, like it's, if you're Muslim or if you're Christian or if you're Jewish, the idea in Buddhism is that there's no external God, there's no external deity, but that the wisdom exists within oneself as well as universally. So what you could call God is, we generally don't use that word, but we sometimes say gods, and sometimes we just mean the whole universe and all the beings, because that's where the wisdom abides. And so it probably would be difficult if you really hold to a view of one specific God, then it would actually be hard to say, well, okay, it's time for me to become a Buddhist. It's probably not time yet, or if it would be time in this life, you know, that might, we can just wait and see. There's no pressure. Because there's always still all of the practice and all of the path, and you can continually engage, but you don't want to take a vow that you don't mean. That's my big rule. So there's this little book called The Refuge Vow, a source book, which when people register for this program, anyone can buy it, but when people register, we ask them to buy it and read it, because it's talks by many great teachers, including my two teachers and several other great Tibetan teachers of the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. And it's all talks on different ideas or different aspects of taking refuge and becoming a Buddhist. And so just from the very first paragraph of the first talk, which is written by Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the founder of Shambhala. In the Buddhist tradition, the purpose of taking refuge is to awaken from confusion and associate oneself with wakefulness. Taking refuge is a matter of commitment and acceptance, and at the same time, of openness and freedom. By taking the refuge vow, we commit ourselves to freedom. So, freedom, what does freedom mean? Because a lot of times you think, oh, well, I'm free, I have no, there's no bonds, there's no, but we're actually completely bound to the continual stream of our thoughts and emotions. So in this case, that's the freedom. The freedom isn't from another person. The freedom is freedom from our own karmic mind stream, this stream that's been running since the moment we were born that says, I want, I don't want, I do want, I don't want, I want so much. I want you so much. And I don't want it at all. And so the actual statement of the refuge vow is that we go for refuge, meaning like refuge like under the shade of a tree. We go for refuge in three things: in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So that's actually the whole vow, is that you say those words three times. And so the Buddha doesn't represent a god. The Buddha is a human being who walked a particular path and experienced both tremendous good fortune and also saw how much suffering there is in the world, at every level of the world, in the sea, in the forests, and in the human realm, you know. And so that there's this tremendous richness and also this tremendous sorrow, and we always think we're going to like parse them and just get, be able to somehow sort them out and just keep the good and not have the suffering. And he saw the integrated quality of the two. And then when he began teaching, when he had his realization, people would just see him and recognize that this person was free. And the reason they could see that is because he wasn't preoccupied with himself at all. He was just, so in images they always show the great masters and people like the Buddha as having a big aura around them, big rainbow or a circle of light. And so it's not necessarily that there was literally a circle of light, but that there was, that people could actually see their radiance because it was so unprotected and so completely open. And not, we think, well, if I'm too open, I'm going to get slammed. But when you actually have trained properly, that openness has tremendous strength and power and dignity. And you can see that in, you know, many, many great people who've been leaders in our world, you know, people who've like really know how to be open without it being weakness. And, you know, you can see it in Martin Luther King or in Mahatma Gandhi or in Mother Teresa or in many, many, many other great, you know, great humanist leaders, leaders who've shifted the paradigm of our society over the decades and centuries, and who weren't particularly Buddhist, but were awakened. So we take refuge in the Buddha as an example that a person can do that. And when the Buddha taught, then people said, I would like to be your student. And he gave them instructions. He said, follow this way. And they did, and many of them attained realization. And then people met them. Those people wandered in whatever circles they wandered, and people met them and said, please teach me, and they taught them. And so in every generation for 2,600 years, it's been a continually living personal experience of becoming awakened. And not everybody becomes like 1,000% awakened, but if you became 5% more awakened, it would feel really good. And if you became a little more than that, it would feel it would actually be meaningful. And it would not just be meaningful to you, it would be meaningful to the people in your life, the people you work with and the people that you meet on the street and the people you care for. So the Buddha is the example in this case, not the God, not the deity. He's just the example that there's a way and it can be done. And then the way that he taught is called the Dharma. So the Dharma has many, it's said many ways. It's a, it can be said as the law or the way or the path or the nature of the phenomenal world. And so all of the teachings that the Buddha gave, but also all the teachings that all of the students of the Buddha have given through all of the times since the Buddha. So that's a lot of teachings and a lot of interpretations, many of which are slightly different from each other because they're cultural. They're not bound to a gospel. They're bound to the direct experience of the people in the room at the time, just like this. And the way that one teacher expressed it, and sometimes the way that one teacher commented on the way another teacher expressed it. All of these things are called the Dharma. And the Dharma has certain characteristics which could be bound up in the nutshell of intention to cause less harm. And then a secondary, if you get okay at that, if you get to like stage 1.5 of cause less harm, you can start working on do better. Be good, you know. Not just, so the first thing isn't be good. The first thing is just let's try to be less bad. And less and become aware of our own impact on the world, our own footprint, and all and the waves we create as we walk through the world. And the waves are just like the impact of our own emotions and thoughts on the people around us and the world around us. Wouldn't that be nice to see in a leader? So, So, oh yeah, did I say I was from a lefty family on the Lower East Side? And so, and then, so the Dharma is the second refuge, and the third refuge is called the Sangha, and the Sangha is the community. So Sangha is the Sanskrit word for the community of practitioners, and this is the Shambhala community, the Shambhala tradition evolves out of a Tibetan lineage. And so just to note that in Tibetan, the word for the community is called Gendun. And Genden means those who aspire to virtue. So those who aspire to lead virtuous lives, to be decent, upstanding citizens, and citizens in whatever world you're in, whatever corner of the world, or whether it's very small, just your family, or just your own home, or if it's your workplace, or if it's, you know, as you take the subway, that's your, that's where you're being a citizen. Wherever you are is where you're being a citizen. And it could also be on a larger stage as well, of course, but it doesn't need to be. So the Gendon is the community of those who aspire to virtue. And so traditionally, the people who take refuge are the Sangha, or the community. Usually the word we mostly use is Sangha, not Genden, but I think the translation of the Tibetan word is important and useful. And so so generally speaking, we think of the Buddha as enlightened, and the way that he teaches is the way for us to get from here to there. And the community of practitioners are the people who are on that way. So they're not particularly enlightened, but they have they have good intention, and they're supporting each other. They're kind of sometimes smacking you upside the head, and sometimes helping to lift you up. And we serve that role for each other in a large sense. So there are many other things we could talk about refuge, and maybe people who have questions or thoughts about this or would like to ask. And I'd like to just say one other thing, that so this weekend that we'll be teaching in later in April, at the end, at the culmination of the program, we give the refuge vow. The whole weekend is the leading into the vows. And so it's a good training. So even if you're not ready beforehand, you have a chance to get synchronized. But there are a few things. I mean, I think that it's important that people actually have a meditation practice, and not that it's not the first thing that you do. The first thing you don't do is meet someone and marry them. You want to have a little experience of what it's like to have dinner with them and wake up in the morning or so, and see if you still want to see them that evening. And so I think it's not particularly a Shambhala. It's not a vow to be a Shambhala member. It's a vow to be a student of the Buddha. So that's a much larger and less specific thing. So refuge vow is considered the vow of all Buddhist traditions rather than a specific one. And then later on, there are more specific. If you keep going in one tradition, the vows get a little more specific, but refuge is very, very open. So, we were just offering the microphone. So we have a microphone if you have anything you'd like to ask or add.
I think it's also called the righteous path.
It could be called the righteous path. Or it's called the Eightfold Noble Path. Yes. Hello, sir.
Hi, Acharya. How are you doing? I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the significance of the refuge name.
So when you take refuge, you get a Dharma name, which is called the refuge name. And so there's people within the weekend program, people have a short meeting with the preceptor, which in this case would be myself, and we sit together for a minute or two, and I might ask you a couple of questions, and then somehow magically out of that, there's some insight that expresses itself as a name. And sometimes people use their Dharma name in different ways. So sometimes people use their... So the name is then bestowed, given at the end of the ceremony after you have formally taken the vow. And the name is an insight into your basic nature. And I have a little story. So I took refuge with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche when I was 21. I'm 65. And when I was 21, I was a really, really, really introverted little gay boy who didn't know, in a time when that wasn't common, and who didn't know, have any idea how to express myself or who I was going to be in the world. And he gave me the refuge name Golden Light of Intellect. And I would say that at that time, there was exactly one person in the universe who would have looked at me and said, that's Golden Light of Intellect. And now I think, how did he know that? I mean, God, I just think it's such a great name, and that I mean, I don't mean to brag, but I like it. I don't think it doesn't fit. So the name is simply, sometimes it's very quizzical, like how when you get your name. And how many people here have taken refuge, Val? Do you want to say your refuge name?
It's Jinpalamo, and it means generosity, divine lady.
Thank you. And who gave you that name? Anybody else? Yes?
So my refuge name is Compassion Joyful Light.
My refuge name is Zizi Tachog, which means confidence steed.
Confidence what?
You tell me, you gave it to me. Confidence.
I couldn't.
Steed?
Steed.
Yeah. And whenever I tell somebody, like a Shambhala teacher, that that's my refuge name, they're always like, so good job on that one.
I wouldn't say that steed is one of the words I give names I give very frequently. So there you go.
My refuge name is Nima Serzo, which stands for Sun Gold Lake. And I think of the name as a koan. I have to admit, when you gave it to me, I thought, wow, okay. But I think about it often, and it has different meanings to me at different times.
Mm. Okay, so moving on from names. Any other questions about anything that you'd like to ask me about while I'm here?
I have a question. You mentioned that we need a meditation practice prior to taking the refuge vow. Are there any other prerequisites? Any classes that we need?
We would want you to read this book, and also you have to understand that when you take the vow, you're taking a vow not to cause harm. So usually one of the things that Buddhists do is they try not to kill other beings. So you have to...
So I can't kill that fly anymore.
Well, you can't kill every fly. Sometimes you just gotta kill a fly, I gotta say, but... My theory about mice and cockroaches is if they behave, I'll behave. And then sometimes you actually have to create a boundary or you have to move, right? Yeah. So
I think I've heard you talk about this before, and correct me if I'm wrong, you mentioned that when you chose to take refuge, you felt like you were already there, and so it was pretty, I don't know, I could be remembering it wrong, but I thought you said that it was either pretty obvious or simple or maybe easy?
So it's that it took me a long time to get there, and then once I was there, I was there. I was like, and then it took me a while before there was a ceremony, a refuge vow ceremony, given in a place I could get to at a time I could get there. So it took me a long time to get there, and then it took a while for it to actually happen. So by the time it happened, yes, I was like, I felt like, okay, this is, I wasn't jumping ahead at that moment.
So if it's not too personal of a question, the long time to get there part, and then, okay, let me find a place where I can participate in the ceremony. Is it possible for you to describe sort of what it was that flipped you into it, or is it too non-conceptual to put words on? Or?
Well, you'll remember I was really young. And I was basically being born, you know, at the end of my adolescence when I met Trungpa Rinpoche. So, and actually what I did is I did a retreat. So I did a retreat. We have a meditation center in Vermont called Karme Choling.
I just got back from
And
there.
I did a 10-day solitary retreat there in the summer of 1973, and things were very different. Things were much less structured then than they are now, it's not that anything happened during my retreat that particularly was like so enlightening. It was like how much happened after my retreat that things shifted so much, my perception and my sort of realization of emptiness of that things aren't as solid as we think they should be, as they purport to be. And so there was a big gap at the end of that retreat where kind of things fell away. Things I believed showed me they weren't real or true. And so there was a big sense of falling, but also of freedom. That was my experience.
Thank you.
I've been coming to Shambhala for about 2 years, and I have found it to be really just extraordinarily worthwhile on so many levels and very deeply. But the notion of doing something like a vow and prostrating oneself seemed very, very uncomfortable to me. Mm-hmm. And I came tonight to see how I could work through that. I came in here, sitting out there and sitting in here at the beginning, really struggling with it and really heightening. And all of a sudden like that, it just disappeared. And I felt like this opening up within myself of like seeing this path much more clearly. My concerns just seemed superficial in comparison to what I felt was opening up as a possibility of going through this ceremony. So my question is, if we aren't able to come in April, when would be the next opportunity?
So I do this every year in the spring here, every year. And then also I do it once in a while in other places like Boston or Philadelphia or Chicago. And also other teachers in Shambhala do it, other acharyas. So the acharyas are the top level of teacher who gives these vows, where Sakyong's kind of generals. So it's something that's given on a, you know, not frequent but regular basis. And so when people register, we ask them to just meet with a meditation instructor, which they'll set up here. So just that someone can talk to you and make sure you know what you're doing, we know someone just checks it out. So it's not a particularly a pass-fail. It's just like in case someone's really not ready. And so something like that, like you, it would be a really great opportunity to have a one-on-one conversation with a meditation teacher to just talk about, you know, what you think is happening and or are afraid of might be happening, and make sure that we're copacetic.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you need to have a recommendation from the meditation instructor by April 7th? That's what I read on the website.
Yeah, April 7th or the day before the program, but yeah. Whichever comes first. Yes.
In terms of doing no harm, does that exclude people who do the harm to themselves? For example, can addicts not take the vow?
It's generally considered not. So there are these priests. There are these vows, which are the traditional vows of the of a Buddhist, which are not taking the life of others. Not being deceptive, meaning not lying, but lying is very subtle, so means trying to be without deception. Not abusing your charisma, so traditionally that would be, say, sexual abstinence, but we don't say it, I wouldn't say it that way. If you're taking refuge with me, I'm not expecting you to become sexually abstinent. And stealing, not taking that which is not offered to you, not lying, and not abusing your charisma. And then the fifth one is not getting intoxicated in a way that you then go do the other four things. So that was really, so in fact, you know, so no, the only reason that the addiction thing would be a problem is that if you are not willing to take responsibility for your own actions, but I would say that anyone who was strongly contemplating taking refuge would be doing it as a with the intention of taking responsibility for one's own actions, even if one's also trapped in a realm of sorts. So interestingly, in the early 70s, when Chögyam Trungpa was teaching, I mean, he was known for drinking, and so our whole community was known for drinking. Because we emulate the teacher. And but what was never ever permissible is you couldn't like get drunk and do something bad and then and do something stupid and then just say, oh, I was drunk. There was no excuse. So if you violated your own dignity or that of others, then that was entirely yours to own, and not the alcohol or whatever. So, and I, so he was a very iconoclastic, unusual teacher. Yes, hi.
Two questions, or two-part question. The first is if you maybe don't feel ready for the vow, or are kind of working through some of that that you were talking about feeling aspirations but not feeling in control or how to take them, taking your words and making them mine. But any thoughts or things you could share in such a situation? And the second one is, in present day, are we... if you talk about that conceptual versus feeling kind of mode you were talking about, are we in a lull with that? Are we at a peak compared
say
to...
That, say that again?
You said for you know, over 2,600 years, there was the Buddha, and then he shared, and then yeah. His disciples shared, and so on and so forth. In present day, has that exponentially increased with people, or... did it get lost and it's coming back? Was that, how did that kind of go?
I think we're in a golden age Honestly, I think that what happened, particularly in Tibet, is that for 1,300 years, Tibet walled itself off behind the Iron Mountain wall of the Himalayas and was protected and developed a society where people just practiced deeply. They practiced and studied and contemplated the Dharma and came to extraordinary numbers of great masters manifested and taught and wrote commentaries on other commentaries, but all of that was contained like a diamond within Tibet. And with the Mao's armies crashing through that wall, and also just, which would have happened anyway because of the modern age, because of planes and transportation and communication, you couldn't have kept, I mean, Tibetan remained 13th century well into the midway to the 20th century. So at some point, some modern thing was going to leak in. And so indeed it did. And so we can say, well, it was that thing, but it would have been something else. And so because of that, so many extraordinary teachers came out of Tibet, the ones who survived, who weren't destroyed, killed, and imprisoned by Mao's armies, came out and wandered the earth to Africa and South America, Europe and North America. And really, one of the loudest voices of that first rolling out, that first thunderous wave, was Trungpa Rinpoche, who wrote the book that caught my mind, was Meditation in Action, and that was followed by Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism and Myth of Freedom. So that was all still the early 70s, and he hadn't even said the word Shambhala yet. So... And then we, Shambhala, in the 70s, we brought so many other major great teachers. We hosted His Holiness the Dalai Lama the first time he came to America when no one knew who he was. There was no Nobel Prize yet, no world stage yet. And we picked him up at the airport and drove him around. And so, you know, so this is really an extraordinary time. And when I was at that time, there were two Dharma books. There was Meditation in Action, and there was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And there was Three Pillars of Zen, three Dharma books. And now there are literally a trillion. So I think it's a very fortunate time, and I think that part of that is the response to also the shifting culture that people are desperate for signs of life in the universe. So perhaps we should end and have our snacks. Okay, I just want to really thank everyone for coming. I really appreciate your attention, and also that people show up on a Tuesday night, because everyone's tired and busy, and there are so many things you could do. So thank you for coming and practicing and for listening and participating with your mind and heart.
Mind and heart and headphones and iTunes, for all the ways that you participate and listening to the podcast, thank you. Visit us at ny.shambhala.org for information about classes and weekend retreats. Again, our Shambhala Training Weekend 1 is coming up next, the weekend of May 5th, with Lodro Rinzler. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. But if you are in the New York City area, come say hi. Our weekly Dharma gathering happens every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person, meet the teachers, meet the other people. It's great. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, and have a great week.